In his talk, Mike alluded to the fact that there is this, what, sixth, seventh, which, whatever number we're up to, bombing campaign going on in Iraq, going on in Syria, maybe still going on in parts of Africa. There is, however, some opposition. I think that's a great idea, and I hope you'll talk with us at the reception immediately following this. Let me get a couple other questions. Ted?
And I think the new Jim Crow and, you know, Michelle Alexander's book and also The Situation has made a big difference. And I would, if you were to ask me what movements there were in the United States, I think there's a real movement around the prison system and changing the drug laws. And I think that's going to be a real growing movement. That coupled with perhaps, you know, an immigration movement, a low-wage workers movement, and what's happening at Ferguson, police violence, and there is, maybe referring to this, there should be perhaps a way to begin to think about how those movements can work together. And I'm not, at this point, I can't answer that. They have to figure that out. But we certainly have strong movements in those areas, and probably people can name a couple more. So I'm hopeful on that. From a legal perspective, I have no hope whatsoever about changing the Citizens United case. It gets worse every time we go to the court. Perhaps if the court changes, it'll reverse that decision. But, you know, money is very important to the people who run this country. And, you know, people used to say, we don't really have one person, one vote, because, you know, a person who can pay a lot of money controls 10 votes, 100 votes, 1,000 votes, or a million votes. That system, including the system in Congress because of that, I think is very difficult to change from a legal point of view. I think if people start demanding it, perhaps we can do that on a grassroots level. But from it's almost fruitless. I mean, even Obama didn't stay on, you know, the legal limits of fundraising because his opponent didn't. So you already had the system shot to hell. They already have the belief, like, you know, I remember when we first saw the sign in a window, Mike Bloomberg for mayor. So what was it, 13 years ago? My daughter's 10 years old at the time, and she says, Daddy, Daddy, who's that? And I say to her, I don't know. I've never heard of him. He doesn't have any chance. And $75 million later, he became our mayor. Three times. Right. So the point of that is that the exemption now in the court for very rich people to buy elections is wide open and not going anywhere. I'm not sure what the position of the ACLU is right now on this anymore, but they were ones who, you know, equated for a long time money and free speech. I don't. So.
Oh, that. Do we have any questions?
Well, that they're litigating, that there's people litigating, the individual attacks state by state are being heavily litigated every time they go into effect. You know, having to do with how many days you can vote, what you know, the hours for closing, all identity cards, and they're having mixed results.
All right, let's go over this way. Naomi, and then come on.
I think a lot of people know about the mass incarceration phenomenon, but I don't think that many people know about the special gulag that exists in federal prisons in this country, all over the country, as a result of the Patriot Act and similar types of legislation that is directly tied to the surveillance and entrapment of young Muslims in the United States. Where solitary confinement is used and all kinds of special regulations to isolate and put these prisoners at a disadvantage. That's been particularly intractable. I mean, I've been working around some of these cases for several years. And I'm wondering what you think we can do, what kind of approach we can make to that issue that will help, first of all, publicize it, and secondly, attack it.
Now they're gonna put me behind one of those green screens, and then they're all gonna be that, what's the lion and the whatever, they come to the Wizard of Oz, and then you're gonna ask me the questions. And because I don't do the litigation at my office, but we do that litigation. It's called communications management units, is part of it, and we have clients who are in the communications management unit. They're practically underground. You can't touch your loved ones. You get one call every 6 months. You're behind plastic, and they're horrible, and they originally were set up for Muslims. There's no question about it. But because that looked too horrible when we started raising the issue, they threw in a few animal rights, quote, terrorists, and a few others to make it look like this was a different thing. But those are being heavily litigated now. One question we always had, and I'll leave it at that, because you obviously need to get out the word much more about it, and their litigation can probably push with some grassroots work and do better. I think both the ACLU and the Center are litigating CMUs. When we first did the Guantanamo cases, and Guantanamo was unique for a certain period of time, because there was real torture going on. But the question we always had was whether we should attach it into what was happening in US prisons as well, and whether that would make us a stronger movement to try and say, this is Guantanamo, but this is also happening in US prisons. I don't have the answer. We didn't do it. I don't know how conscious it was that we didn't do it, but we didn't do it. In retrospect, I think it would have been better to not say that this is this at Guantanamo, except for the fact they've never been charged and never tried, but their conditions on their forever detention. This is actually an extension of the US prison system, and maybe that would have been a way of looking at it a little differently. But I agree, it's a very, if you get stuck in an elevator for an hour, I go completely nuts. I'm serious. So think about these places people are in, certainly 23 hours a day, and oftentimes they don't get their hour of exercise.
Okay, over here.
In around 2008, I believe, the government had to see an NSA turn over their raw, unfiltered data to Israel. Congressional and administration messages. My question is, since they have all this data that should be private, shouldn't there be an existing law on the books that's supposed to protect us, just as the FISA courts protect us at home, since they have everything that NSA collects?
Oh. I mean, what you're referring to, I don't know how many people know about it. It was a terrible thing that happened and came out, I think it was a Glenn Greenwald article in The Intercept, I forgot who wrote it, about NSA turning over a lot of the raw data to Israel on people who were not criminal at all, but who might be gay or in an affair or whatever, both Palestinians and Israelis. And then Israel had the ability to be able to go after those people, blackmail, do whatever else to them. And it's a scandal we're just beginning to find out about, really. And someone And someone suggested to me it might be a perfect kind of lawsuit in terms of, you know, representing some of those people if we can figure out how to do it. Should there be a law? You know, of course there should be. Have we gotten any restrictions through Congress on any of this stuff with the NSA yet? We came close on one, but very, very little. All of the hype we had about it, all of Obama's speeches, you know, it's still all going on. And it's not just the NSA. I was at a conference the other day on cybersecurity by all the big guys, and the general counsel for Verizon was there, and he is so conservative and so right-wing. What he said to us, he said, whenever the people from Silicon Valley, you know, all the Google types and all those, want to do something a little different or protect our information, he just says, I was at 9/11, and I remind them that we are responsible for the security of the United States. So it's not just the NSA. It's these telephone providers, Verizon in particular. And if you remember Snowden's first revelation, the first order that he brought out of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was the one that authorized Verizon to take all the metadata on our telephones. So, what? No, they all.
AT&T had a special room where
yes,
they routed everybody's
right.
information.
Yeah, no, they're all.
About that was 2008.
And they lost the litigation, unfortunately. There was the guy who found it. So I'm just saying, restraining the NSA is not an easy task right now. Not an easy task.
Is that because there's no one that has any standing to sue because we don't know what Israel's doing with the information?
That's how we've lost the cases so far. The next case we may not lose because we're getting better and better information on who it's targeted for. But the ACLU argued a case that came close. They didn't actually have someone saying, we're doing it to Glenn Greenwald, we're doing it to Michael Ratner, we're doing it to Guantanamo attorneys. But they had the criteria meant that they were. The Supreme Court, 5-4, said there's no one who can actually prove it was done to them. What you're referring to is standing. But I think we're going to get there. I was going to say, Bolivia has the law of the, what's it called?
Yeah, against
special law.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of strategic reasons for that, as well as moral reasons, that I think that opens up an area that could be advantageous to us all. And I was thinking that 3 months ago, Fidel met with Putin. Fidel has dropped out of all the news, right? But he met with Putin, and I was looking at what they talked about. They didn't actually, I couldn't find the actual content, but I saw the outline, and it was Fidel going on for, as he does for hours, against genetic engineering. And following that meeting, as I understand it, Putin banned all genetic engineering in Russia.
I'm amazed.
Now I have to check that, I didn't check that, but yeah, that's how I understand it right now, right? So on the one hand, Putin, oh, sorry that anybody has that power to just on the other hand, button.
Law you're referring to, it's called the law of Mother Earth. It's called the law of Mother Earth, and I'm familiar with it because one of my kids was in Bolivia, and they love this law, and it's a great law because it encompasses all the communities and the Earth itself when you're doing anything.
Right.
And so I think it's actually
a whole new area right. that we could take advantage of also.
It's like giving trees rights.
Even though we can't really affect our own government for years now, it seems that our actions, including Brooklyn for Peace, affect what other people around the world take up that affect their government, that then affect the U.S. government in a roundabout way, in an indirect way, such as on genetic engineering in Europe, or in Africa, where they prevented genetic engineering in Zambia. So there's hope in this roundabout way, but we need to pull it together.
This was always my great hope. So you've struck, I think the law of the Mother Earth I love, and we should go back and look at it again. But even my work, I remember in the 80s in Central America, this may have been naive, there were all those revolutions, right? Nicaragua, Salvador. My hope was struggle on the periphery, that by doing that in the peripheral colonies of the United States, it would shift and change something here. So all related. I think those are great.
Right there and then there.
So you are going to do that at CCR, right?
Law of the Mother Earth, I think we will. I like it. Do you remember I made 10 suggestions for what I would do if I were Attorney General? I did it in the Independent. And the 10th one was adopting the law of the Mother Earth. So.
good evening. I need a clarification. I listened to people representing Hamas, and I haven't heard what Destroy Israel. And every time I read something from some Zionist or something, whatever, it's always, we don't like Hamas, we want to destroy Israel. It's in their charter or something like that. Can you clarify?
The charter point?
I
probably can't clarify it perfectly. I can just tell you, you know, Noam Chomsky gave a long piece on Democracy Now! About 3 weeks ago. And he talked about the piece, say, it might be worth, because I'm just going to, like, parrot it, basically. He talked about the Hamas Charter, and he said, look, the Hamas Charter, whatever it says in the Charter, it was put together by a few people long years ago that doesn't really represent Hamas, and they were willing to go into a 50-year truce with Israel. So that's the way he talked about that. Then he talked about the Likud Charter. That was more interesting. Likud is Netanyahu's party. The Likud Charter has in it, and this is more serious according to Chomsky, because Likud runs the government and can actually carry out what's in their charter. Likud's charter says there shall never be a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River. So what we get here, and it's propaganda, we always hear about the Hamas Charter without certainly the fact that they were going to enter a 50-year truce. We never hear Netanyahu's Likud charter, which says essentially no Palestinian state, no West Bank at all. So I can give you that answer to that particular question.
Okay, Ed? Stand up and talk louder.
Am I talking louder?
Yes!
It's my understanding that without Assad endorsing the United States intervention in Syria, that it's a violation of international law for the United States to do what it's doing in Syria. And my sense or understanding is that that's caused some problems for many European countries who are being asked to join us. So I'm just curious, is it a violation? Is it causing some problems? And what might, you have to speculate on what that might all mean?
You know, certainly if Syria has not given authority to the United States to bomb in its country, it's a violation of international law. The UN Charter is very clear that the territorial boundaries of a country are sacrosanct, and you can't go bomb inside a country. The U.S. does it frequently with drones and everything else. Perhaps parts of Europe do it occasionally. Europe, I think probably I haven't read what Europe said about that, but assuming Europe says we're nervous about the fact that there's no authority and we don't want to join the United States when they're crossing a border and creating aggression, essentially. Europe has generally, but I want to be careful about this, been more willing to adhere to those laws than the United States. And I would say that's for two reasons. One is they need the legal protections more because they don't have the armies that the United States has. And secondly, perhaps after 400 years of war, they prefer not to get into big wars again. They believe in the rule of law somewhat more than the biggest bully on the block. But the point is, what you're saying sounds accurate to me. If Assad didn't give that permission, Europe might be reluctant to join them without that permission. Now, what you never know what's really been said. That's all I'll say. Assad may say publicly, I haven't given permission, but he may be very happy to have the U.S. coming in there and wiping out ISIS. And he may be, in some way, telling them I am, but I don't know.
All right, we'll take two last questions, and then we'll go downstairs and talk informally.
Mother Earth lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
It seems to me that this is a very important direction for the youth to be going in, who are now mobilized around climate change, and may not still grasp the issue of imperialism. But this is kind of the ultimate imperialism is, you know, taking over the Earth. Do you see any possibility of something like that having a chance?
You know, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the lawsuit. There's certainly a lot of work been going on about the commons and trying to regain the commons and movements. You know, in terms of, you know, I think the climate march was an illustration about the number of young people who are now potentially there to move people and to move this country in a different direction. And I think that's where the energy is. And if I looked at a lawsuit like that, what I would want it to be was part of a strategy of a strong grassroots movement of people. And then I would think it would represent a chance. A lawsuit sitting there just because, I don't know the circumstances, maybe it does. Yeah, I actually have heard something about that part of it. But I'm just saying, if a movement is built up behind it, and you get a judge, and there's chances at those things. But I guess can't stress the importance of, as we all know, of grassroots movements that make change. I mean, and I'll just, you know, I came to my office only because I wanted to do cases that I agreed with representing grassroots movements. It started with the Southern Civil Rights Movement, anti-war movement, went on from there. When we took the Guantanamo cases, that was almost the first case that I'd ever taken in which there was not a grassroots movement. And in which I actually had no movement at all, but it was a pure legal case. I just felt it was so harsh what was going on that my office had a debate about it and had to take it. So I generally go very strongly with wanting to go with grassroots. And my son, who, as I said, works at Immokalee Workers, as far as he's concerned, you know, lawyers can go north and do whatever they want. So.
We'll take one last question and then go downstairs.
How do you deal with this country when they see the beheading of journalists by ISIS? Because I know in Saudi Arabia and Iran and these other countries that behead people and they treat women like crap in these countries. And how do you answer them and how do you deal with that question?
You know, those are hard. The beheading, none of us, maybe there's some people here who could watch the video. I certainly certainly couldn't watch it. And so it's a horrible, graphic description that inflames people. And I think what you have to, I mean, no one is saying that's good or the right thing to do. So that's obvious. What you also have to do is put things in a context of how, why is that coming about? How many children were killed in Gaza during the 2 months before? And how one thing inflames you, but the other thing should inflame you as well, and so we should look at those in those ways. It's hard to do because that is such; those images are very graphic and very difficult, and you don't want to back away from saying that's horrible because that's horrible.
Thank you, Michael. I think you'll agree he is a genuine pathmaker to peace. Come join us downstairs.
Thanks,
let's chat some more. Thank you.
A little more. You wore me out here.
Oh, come on.
No microphone.
I want to talk to you about CASA too, and you know what's going on.